This is Flight Training the Way I See It with Mike Schiffer. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Flight Training the Way I See It. News, opinion, commentary by your host. That's me, Mike Schifflin. How you doing? This is the August podcast, and it follows our August newsletter. So if you don't belong to our newsletter group, then you can go to our website, cfibootcamp.com, and at the top you'll find a way to opt into the newsletter. Also, we do a power hour every Saturday from noon Eastern time until 1 o'clock. It's on a single topic, something like the mathematics behind 8-sum pylons, marketing 101 for instructors. We just finished one, a day in the life of a flight instructor. We do deep dives and maneuvers. Any aviation-related topic is on the table. You have how to use ForeFlight to teach, how to use ForeFlight in general. All these things are done in our power hours. We've done 100 episodes, and we will do the 101st one here this Saturday. And that will be a recorded one. I've already recorded that because they're usually live, but I'm going to be traveling to San Francisco. So I'll be there starting tomorrow, leaving tomorrow, and I'll be there until next Monday. So that's what's on my plate because we have an initial CFI class that I'm teaching at our Palo Alto location. So let me give you the run of what we're going to do today in the podcast. And again, if you're new, welcome. If you've been here for a long time, well, welcome back. There we are. We're going to start a new series in the newsletter on this podcast. It's going to be tips and techniques to try in a single engine airplane, pro tip series. So we did this for the multi, and we're going to do it for the single. We'll talk about that in a second and what those three tips are going to be today. We have those already ready for you. And then we're going to talk about a radio communications technique that will basically says how to get what you want more often. If you use this technique or the series, these little three little things I can give you, more often than not, you're going to get what you want from air traffic control. And it's a real simple thing to follow. So it won't take a lot of effort here to be able to do this. And I think you'll really like that. That'll be something. So you've got that. And let's move along ahead. Then after that, I've got, this is my approach to learning to fly a new airplane. This has worked for me so far. So I'm going to tell you my approach to getting checked out in a new airplane, how I approach it, and things of that nature. So we're going to discuss that. And then I'm going to tell you about a new book that I'm writing, an aviation book, but non-training book. It's not about technique or procedure. It's built for the public and the masses in general, and it's scheduled for me to have it written in a year. So it could take a lot less than that, but I'm giving myself that amount of time because it's quite an extensive book, okay? And that'll be available everywhere in about a year. So particularly Amazon is where we'll start with that. So just so you know, and I'll tell you what's gonna be in it, and I'll look for some of your input as the time goes on. So let's dig right into it. Let's dig into all this stuff. Let's talk about first, radio communications technique, how to get what you want more often. So what I'm gonna talk to you about is what people typically do wrong and then how we can fix it. It's really easy to fall into the trap of radio communications being just a thing, and you press the button, you say what you want, and then hopefully you get what you want, and hopefully you're not too intimidated by the radio communications to actually try to ask what you want. But more often than not, what we get is training in non-busy airport environments. You always get what you want if it's slow. If it's slow, if it's reasonable, then you're going to get what you want. So we're going to talk about how to get the things you want, like maybe a clearance direct to, or maybe you need a Class B clearance, or maybe you need something, and it's really busy on the radio. So a lot of people don't have the benefit of this kind of training. If you train in Palo Alto or Miami, it's going to be busy, so you're going to hear that a lot. And so what you're going to hear, though, is in training, you're going to hear a lot of people who chime in at the wrong moment because they don't listen on the frequency. They don't know when an appropriate moment is. They'll miss radio calls because they're not used to the rapid fire of the ATC traffic calls in this area or other areas like this. And so in the controller's mind, when you do things like that, it puts them off, right? It sets the stage for like, okay, if you're going to ask for something, they're going to think about how much extra bandwidth they're going to have to allocate of their own to accommodate you. Now, if it's a safety matter, safety of flight, that's always going to be fine. But if it's a convenience or something that they think they're going to have to hold your hand on, it's unlikely to happen. But if you sound like you know what's going on, and you haven't cluttered up the frequency and you've sort of fit in through this whole equation, then the controller knows that you at least know that, and chances are you've had good enough training where you can accommodate and do what they want you to do. Okay, so that's the tone of it. We're setting the tone of it here. So how do we do this? So let's see. First, think about the controller's primary responsibilities. Let's take a look at a tower controller. The tower controller's number one priority, if you were to ask them, they will tell you, it is to maintain the runway integrity. That's it. That's the number one thing. I have to make sure that there's no one on the runway, and when I've cleared someone to land, or have adequate spacing, I have to make sure that no one's going to stop on the runway after landing and have maybe a failure of the power plant, can't get off the runway, because everything bottlenecks to the runway, the throughput to the runway, if there's somebody on it. So the first thing the controller is going to do, first priority, is to take care of the runway. Then the second is going to be landing traffic, right? And of course, first will be emergencies, but landing traffic be after that. The third would be then takeoff traffic or traffic in the pattern. So depending on where, so if you're sitting at the run-up area and you're trying to get a takeoff clearance and the controller hasn't sorted out, or you can tell the controller hasn't sorted out who's number one, who's number two. Maybe there's a confusion as to who's number one now, who's number two now, or if this guy's going to get off the runway or not, a girl's going to get off the runway. It's not the appropriate time to ask for your takeoff clearance. Because number one, you're not going to get it. And the second thing is, you just consumed a lot of space by saying something like, as soon as it got busy, you went, Palo Alto Tower, Cessna, November 7840 Sierra Papa. We're in the run-up area with information, November, requesting a right Dumbarton departure. Kink. And when it was real busy, you sucked up all that time. That the controller now doesn't like you. Does not like you. Right? Because number one, his priorities now are not you. And you just became your own priority, right? You became, I'm going to be number one. That's not the way to get it. So knowing the order of things. So in Tricon, you know, it's going to be handoffs to the tower, vectors to a course of some kind, a vector especially to an instrument approach procedure. That aircraft's going to get the most attention, right? Or anybody's off altitude. Those are going to be the priorities. Everything else is going to be sub to that. Right? So if you're new into the game and you're coming in and there's all these clearances being given, it's not the appropriate time to ask NorCal approach, Cessna November 784 Sierra Papa with information Bravo, requesting vectors for the ILS runway 31 at Stockton Airport, at Stockton or 28 or 29, whatever one it is over there. And then the controller now is not on your side anymore, because now maybe someone had to fly through final because they gave him a short vector because you hogged up all that time, right? So let me give you the technique then about how to fix all this, right? So the first thing you know is that you have to do is you've got to focus on the frequency and listen and see what's going on. Get a mental picture of what's happening for a second, right? See if you can estimate the workload of the controller. Then you're going to hear what's going to happen is the controller is going to speed up their cadence when it gets busy. So if they're not busy, they'll say 784 Sierra Papa, turn left 230, and when able, proceed direct to Palo Alto Airport. That's it, right? Pretty easy, right? But when they get busy, they'll say 784 Sierra Papa, turn left 8300, proceed direct to Palo Alto. Or they'll do it in pieces. They'll say 784 Sierra Papa, turn left heading 320. November 783 Zulu Papa, climb maintain flight level 210. And 784 Sierra Papa, now proceed direct to Palo Alto. So the cadence is there, right? So you need to match the cadence as closely as you can. So speak at the same cadence the controller speaks. Also, the controller will provide gaps for readbacks, for various things. And you can hear how big the gap is because it's pretty consistent. And so for example, 784 Sierra Papa, turn left heading 320. And then he's giving you enough time to say that. Left turn heading 270, 784 Sierra Papa. Now, correction, 320, 784 Sierra Papa. That's it, you sucked up more time, but you got it in, right? Because you said it quickly. And you didn't do anything above or below that. And so the gap worked. So the idea is when the controller gives you a gap, that's what you've got to, it's the time you have to build in. So if you're trying to check in for something, maybe you need flight following, you need something else, And there's a short gaps like that. You can't just say everything you want all at once. You can't just say, like I've said before, NorCal approach, this, the 784s, and keep all going, droning on and on and on. You might have to shorten it up, terse it up, and just say something like this. A NorCal 784 Sierra pop request. That's it, nothing else. And then the controller will think about the workload, think about, he knows that you called, or she knows that you called, and then we'll kind of get back to 784 Sierra pop, say request, you know? And then you say request flight following, Cessna 172 or something, 74 Sierra Papa, right? That's it. And then let it go out in pieces. So mind the gap, mind the gaps, and then fit into the gaps. And I think you'll get a lot more love that way from the controllers. They'll know that at least you're aware of their workload and that you can speak quickly enough to fit in. So if they give you an instruction, and you don't miss a radio call, right? You're not missing radio calls. They have to call you twice. That's even a bigger gap, right, that they don't have. So there's that. So that's what I would say. I think if you use this technique, the controller recognizes that you know how to handle a busy environment and that you're paying closer attention to the frequency and the controller's workload. It's moments like this, I say, that where you'll get what you want more often. Okay, so that's the first part of what we're going to do today. The second part is I wanted to talk to you about my approach to learning to fly a new airplane, right? This has worked for me so far. Just a little bit of history so we can see that I kind of know what I'm talking about here. So the last time I looked, I have logged over 16,000 flight hours, mostly in light GA, general aviation, piston airplanes. That's just about, not quite 2 years, 24/7 in the air. So if you go today and you had enough fuel, which you wouldn't, but if you did and you flew for 2 years, just about 2 years, you'd beat me. You'd have a little over 16,000 hours. You might have 17. So sometimes I say a little too much of a good thing, sometimes. I started flying in 1984, and I became a flight instructor in 1995. And I was a pilot examiner for the FAA starting in 1998 to 2009, and also gained UK licenses as well. And a flying instructor license there, as well as examining authority through the CAA in the UK. I went on late after that to fly Cessna Citation, CJ, is what I used to fly corporate, in about 2001 or so. I flew that for a while. So I've been around the block, I guess. I also fly about 67 different kinds of airplanes, so different makes and models. So, you know, why am I telling you this? Because every airplane I get checked out in initially, I'm afraid of. That's true. I've got a big yellow streak. It's huge, right? And I think it's what's given me the distance between safety and between between my my distrust of the airplane. And you know, some people are really gung-ho about these airplanes, and I can be, but I'm really, really, really cautious. And so, and if I have that many hours, even today, if I get checked out in an airplane, I'm going to use the same technique, that I've used for years. I'm going to use the same thing because I don't trust them as far as I can throw them. But after a while, I warm up to them. So it's kind of like my nature. So let me just tell you what, let me just tell you what to do. So far, I say all so far because you got to preface everything with that. I've not had an accident in an airplane. I have not had a violation of any kind. Not even a warning, not even I didn't get called into the FISDO for anything, right? So so a lot of that is my approach to flight safety and my approach to these airplanes. So let me describe with the process that I take. And maybe it might not align with you, but at least consider it. Because a lot of people that I see for airplane checkouts, they just want to do it quickly. And they want to do it in an hour if that's possible, right? The hour thing is like in our industry all over the place. It takes about an hour check out, about an hour. If you can get that out of your head and go for this, I think you're going to be a lot more comfortable and a lot safer in the airplane. So let's just try what that is. And again, it depends on the airplane. If it's an airplane like a 172 and I'm getting checked out in a different, same 172, but just a different location, it's because it's a different rental school or something. My approach to that is going to be a little different. It's not going to be as intense as this is going to be. So let's look at it. The first thing I do is I never get into an airplane that I'm going to end up flying unless I've read the POH and in particular the limitations section. I want to understand what's different than the other airplanes that I fly, and this one that's different than the others. And I want to also know where the danger areas are, because in the limitations section, I'll see placards and I'll see things about don't do this, do that, don't do a VMC demonstration below 4,000 feet, for example, in the Dutchess, and various things that be in there, right? And so I want to really understand what the limitations are. I want to understand if there's, like, certain airplanes have different G load limits, if there's flap down or not. So I want to know kind of things like that. I also want to understand autopilots. I want to understand the limitations of the autopilot, when I can turn it on, when I can turn it off. And I think a lot of pilots don't even know that. Don't even know they have to pre-flight the autopilot if one's installed, right? They don't know, because they don't read the limitations section. So that's the first thing I'm gonna do. And then I'll read the systems description, make sure that I understand what's in this airplane, how it operates, and I'll look at the emergency checklist and correlate that back to the systems section. So basically the systems and descriptions chapter, I'll read that, and then I'll go to the emergency checklist and I'll see what the emergency checklist tells me to do and see if I understand from a systems level, because I read the systems chapter, what's happening. I don't just want to be throwing switches blindly, right? I want to understand what's the purpose of throwing that switch or doing this action. From sometimes by correlating the emergency checklist with the systems description, you can get there. Otherwise, that's a question for my flight instructor, whoever that might be, right? So because they should know more about the airplane than me, although sometimes that's not true. So that's it. Then I fill out what's the equivalent of an aircraft checkout sheet. So I have that ready to go, and I kind of feel that now I've had a chance at this airplane. I'm still afraid of it, but at least I know how it might kill me, as opposed to may I don't know how it's going to kill me, right, at all. So there's that. The second thing I do is, on the first flight, I don't want to do any maneuvers. I think people find that odd, but I don't want to. I don't trust this airplane yet. I don't trust you yet. Getting to know you, getting to know all that stuff, getting to know it, getting to know you. Then I just want to make a flight somewhere. And so the flight is going to be to another airport, right, with a long runway usually. And then I want to see how the airplane behaves on that flight. And in particular, maybe I want this flight instructor to show me how to fly it efficiently. So, for example, if I fly with you in a Beech Baron, a 55, it's got a very low gear down speed. It's right around 130, as I recall, something like this. And so, yet it has no speed brakes. So if you want to fly this airplane efficiently, your planning has to be pretty good from descent to descend, right? Otherwise, you're going to get to the traffic pattern and not be able to slow down, right, in enough time and have to go around. Because an airplane is designed to go, most airplanes are designed to cruise, go at cruise speed. And cruise speed can be pretty fast, right? And if you are flying an airplane, like we had these Japanese guys at Nice Air a long time ago, and they had to get a multi-engine rating in addition, and it had to be in something like a Baron, over 200 horsepower aside. So we had a Baron there. And when I was doing flight exams for them, they would take off, and we would start, get up to level flight, so we'd level off, and then they'd pull the throttles way back to do like 120, 130. This airplane's capable of doing 190, right? And we're doing 130 all the way to Stockton, which is 50 miles away. And I'm like, what's going on here? He says, well, this way we don't have to worry about planning the descent. And we're already near the approach speed. We can put the gear down, and it's just easier. Now, that's not efficient. Is that how you want to fly an airplane? Is that your goal? You know, that's not my goal. My goal is to fly it within the limitations it has. And the purpose of the airplane is to get me there, you know, quickly, or maybe if it's a slow airplane, scenically, right, or whatever it would be. But there's a purpose to it. So I want to see how that's managed, right? So, for example, if we fly a Beech Baron 58, that has a gear speed that's up around 160. So it's a lot easier to manage the speed when you can put the gear down with that much drag so early, right, at such a speed. So it just depends on the airplane. Moonies are tricky as well, and most of them have speed brakes that are effective at high speed but not effective at all at low speed. So these are just kind of things I want to get to know. So I want to understand how this airplane should be flown, right? And maybe that's you or my flight instructor demonstrating that to me, or maybe it's me trying it and they're giving me some guidance on why I'm doing a particular thing. I just don't want to know, hey, do this, do that. I want to know why I'm doing it, right? Once I know the whys or what I'm striving for, then I can self-evaluate and I can make adjustments as I go, right? Otherwise, I just listen to another flight instructor yell at me, which is, that's something about that. So let's move on. The second thing then, that's the second flight. So now that's the first flight. So on the first flight, I'm just going to another airport. That's all I'm doing. Then on the third flight, the second flight, we're gonna do maneuvers. So we can do steep turns, slow flight stalls, we can do all steep spiral, whatever we wanna do, right? That is beneficial to me understanding how this airplane behaves. We can do single engine operations. If it's a twin, we can do engine failures and emergency approach to landing if it's not a twin, and or whatever the case is, right? So I'm good with that. And then if there's time on that flight, then I'm happy to do some takeoffs, landings, go arounds, that kind of thing, right? If there's time. If there's not, then we'll do one last flight, which will be just takeoffs, landings, and go arounds and emergency procedures. So that to me then, once I approach an airplane this way, then I feel that I've got the, I have it, right? And I feel like I'm not afraid of it anymore. I feel that I can manage it. I can be efficient in the airplane. And again, some of these things may take a little longer. I find that most people aren't teaching efficiency. If I ask most pilots at a flight school, they're gonna go on a cross country, right? Student pilot or private pilot building time for commercial. And I say, so what? Where are you gonna go? I'm gonna go here. So how are you gonna get there? They show me the four flight or something. And they say, okay, what airspeed did you plan for? And they said, well, like 100 in a Cessna 172. I'm like, well, why? This airplane will go 120. Why wouldn't it go 100? Because that's where we always go. It's 2,300 RPM. So whether you know, there's other RPM settings that are available to you, right? You don't have to just use 2,300 RPM for the rest of your life, right? And so it's an opportunity to look at the performance section in the POH and see. And then select a speed based upon the conditions, right? If it's smooth, why not go fast? There's no reason. Is there a reason to pull off a lot of power when you're descending? And to bring the throttle back to 1,800 RPM, is that necessary if you're descending? That keeps you at 90 knots, right? That keeps you 500 feet a minute descent at 90 knots. Is that necessary is the question, right? Or wouldn't you just rather get to the airport a little sooner unless you're building time? I get there's all reasons for things, but I want you to have a good solid reason. You're flying the airplane efficiently for the purpose that you had intended, right? Or for the mission, right? For the idea. So I find that's not taught. And so I want to see that. I want to see this instructor fly this airplane a little bit or instruct me in how to fly it efficiently. All right, so once I've done these four things, then I feel like I can fly the airplane, and as long as I stay current with it, proficient with it, I don't feel like there's anything gonna bite me here. Or if it does, I think I'm in good shape to handle it, right? So first to recap, I don't fly an airplane until I've read the POH and I've gleaned out all the essential things like the limitations, performance figures, that kind of thing. Some airplanes have a strange weight and balance profile, like the Columbias. They had a really weird weight and balance, or some of the Bonanzas, you could get them in the wrong way. So stand by. Okay, so to recap on this thing, the four things that I do, the first thing is I'm not going to get an airplane until I've read the POH and I understand the limitations, in particular the things that are likely to be a problem, right? Any limitations, that kind of thing. Like I say, the Bonanza has some of the older Bonanzas have a very weird weight and balance where you can actually get the thing out of balance by you being in the airplane and burning fuel in a particular way. So I wanna know those things. Then the second is I wanna make a flight. It doesn't have to be a long flight. I just wanna see the airplane being operated efficiently, kind of how it behaves, right? I wanna see if it gets squirrely when it's slow or whatever, this kind of thing. I wanna see it from the broad side, the big picture down. Then we make a flight and do the maneuvers, including maybe takeoffs and landings, emergencies, that kind of thing, if there's time to do the takeoffs and landings. Otherwise, we make another flight, which has takeoffs, landings, and go-arounds. And I don't want to skimp on those things because the airplane's behavior, I need to understand, low to the ground, because it's low to the ground the places that we get into trouble, right? Especially if we're teaching in an airplane and we don't understand how the airplane's behaving near the ground, like it has a very strong pitch-up tendency, the elevator trim stall kind of situation, which most airplanes have, right? So how about this one? Or for example, another one is the trim system on a Cessna 172 is pretty loosey-goosey, I'd call it, right? Meaning that you can spin that control wheel quite a long distance and you'll get some measure of result from it, but you have to kind of move it quite a ways. In a Beech Baron, if you do that, if you take the same concept, I'm going to take a big handful of this thing and drag it out, it'll go vertical. I mean, it's very sensitive trim system. So these are the kind of things I want to know. Point out those kind of things to me. And then if we need it, we'll do the last flight, which would be takeoffs, landings, like I said, go-arounds and emergencies. Then I feel confident in it. So that's kept me going, and it's allowed me to actually not have any problems in the airplanes because I truly understand them before I get inside of them. So there's that. All right, let's look at the last couple things we're gonna talk about today. We're gonna talk about these three tips, which I told you, I promised you, right? So in this series, we're gonna provide three tips for single engine airplanes. And then when that's over, when I've given use some measure of them, 10 or 15 or however many of them there might be. Then we'll move on to things like tips for flying float planes and other types of aircraft, right? Or maybe things like, just tips on things in general. So let's start with this month's three tips. Drum roll, please. Okay, so the first one I'm going to talk about, which I've been harping on probably for the last year, and this is when an airplane's coordinated correctly, you don't feel like you're sliding left or right in your seat. So I ask people what coordination means, every CFI class. They always say the same things, which they say when the ball's in the center, which is makes me crazy, right? So yes, that's true, but most of the time, people look at that ball and then they expect it to tell them what to do, right? So they see that it's out and they push on the corresponding pedal and it goes back in the middle. Well, the problem with that whole strategy is you didn't do the right thing or the ball wouldn't have left the middle, right? So you didn't develop a sense of flying yet. You've got a meter there which tells you, okay, you didn't do it right. You didn't do it at all maybe, and here's how to fix it. So is that how you want to fly? By fixing things all the time, or just want to have it in the middle all the time to the extent that you can, right? So when an airplane's coordinated correctly, you will not feel like you're sliding left or right in your seat, because what happens when you're not coordinated is either that centripetal force, which is pulling you into the turn, or the other way, centrifugal force, or even when you're straight ahead or in a turn, are going to be equal if you're coordinated. If you're not, one of those forces is going to be greater than the other, and you're going to slide left or right in your seat, right? So so that's the problem. So knowing that then is... how do we coordinate the airplane then? Well, we develop a sense for if we're sliding in our seat, and we fix it. So if you feel you're sliding to the left or to the right, you push on a corresponding pedal to bring you right back to the middle. You don't need to look at the ball to do that. You can feel that. If you can't feel that, then you need to develop that sense. You can say, well, you have 16,000 hours. Of course, you developed that sense. Well, I had that at 20 hours because someone told me to look out for it. Someone would say, this is, you have to feel this. You can't look for anything. There's nothing to see right there. You got to feel it, right? You got to see if you're sliding left or right. Sometimes you can see things by looking outside. It's true. Adverse yaw, you can see that. But the idea is if you're doing acro, all bets are off, because you sometimes you fly uncoordinated with acro, so this doesn't count. Or if you're doing a crosswind takeoff, crosswind landing, or a forward slip to a landing, you'll be uncoordinated by nature there, so you're not going to feel straight up in your seat then. But in everything else you do, for commercial flying, flight instructor, for a private pilot, whatever it is, if you don't feel like you're straight up down your seat, you're doing it wrong. Okay, you have to feel, you cannot feel like you're sliding at all or your body's moving. It cannot feel like, it feels like a big steel rod from you all the way down to the earth. That's what it should feel like. So, again, if you look at the ball, you're just going to develop that habit. That habit is like, I'm going to look at it, it'll tell me what to do, then I'll fix it. And you won't get better. You really probably won't get that much better. So, but if you'll teach yourself to notice if you're sliding left or right in your seat, you will finally learn how to coordinate an airplane. The last thing I will say is, which I did in a, I think I did this, I've done so much stuff lately, I can't remember where I had espoused this out, but I created another video just like a couple days ago, and it was on coordination. One of the things was on coordination. And one of the things I said that you could do is you could go flying, and again, this stuff you should do with a flight instructor, someone else sitting next to you. Slow the airplane, if it's a 172, down to about 70, pick a point straight ahead, and then take the ailerons and move them all the way right, all the way left, never stopping, all the way right, about this pace, about left. That's going to bank the airplane, right? But what's going to happen is the nose is going to swing the other way when it's banking. It's called adverse yaw, because that wing is slowing down due to the drag that the downgoing aileron is giving. So then what I want you to do after that is then keep the point straight ahead, same, and then do those aileron reversals again, but use exactly the right amount of pedal to keep the nose straight ahead, to keep it on the point, not leaving the point. If you look down there, the ball will always be in the middle end. That's how you start and stop a turn, right? And so by eliminating adverse yaw. And so if you can develop that, and also you can also, most airplanes, not all, but most have pretty balanced flight controls between the aileron input and the rudder input. So, you know, it's a function of speed, of course, but if you're going to pack on all the aileron, you're going to have to pack on a lot of rudder if you're going to do it abruptly and quickly. If it's just a little bit, just need a little bit. So the correlation, the initial rudder input to help you get a head start is proportional. The rudder input is proportional to the aileron input as you put it in. Remember, when the aileron is neutral, you don't have an adverse yaw. So there's that. The second tip of the day is when arriving in a high elevation airport. So we used to fly a lot to Truckee, Lake Tahoe. Now, where's the mixture set? Typically, the mixture is set for your cruise, right? You've cruised it up to there, you're 10,000, 15,000, 12,000 feet. You got the mixture out at some point. Now you're going to descend. So chances are you're going to have to enrich in the mixture. How much? That's a good question, right? Because usually you're going to, you know, normally if you left it, it'll be too lean by the time you get down to the pattern, right? It'll be too lean. And so you won't have full power available to you. It's not good, right? Especially if you went high altitude. So the technique then for us is going to be this, right? So you can enrich in it to what you think on your way down. And when you get to the traffic pattern, when you get down to the traffic pattern, then what I want you to do is I want you to lean the mixture using takeoff power in the pattern. Yeah. In the takeoff, so be in the takeoff configuration, which is not takeoff, takeoff power, whatever that means to your airplane, and lean the mixture for maximum RPM. Then it'll be ready if you have to do a go around. That's the technique, okay? And in the third technique is when pre-flighting airplanes, in particular newer 172s, close the doors. These models after the N model, and some don't have stops, so there's no door stops. So when they open up, the door opens up, it opens up, and the only thing keeping it from going far is the hinge. And when the hinge tweaks, that's it. Those are $750, I think, or $1,250 a piece, the hinges. And it's really easy to tweak them. So if a gust of wind gets that door, slams it out, there's no stops, then you're likely to have to need a few hinges and some maybe some sheet metal work done even on the door, which could be bad, right? You put up some, it could be bad. So you don't really want to do that. So keep the doors closed, and if needed, then you can open the windows, right? There's that. All right, then the last thing I want to talk about, something interesting, right? I think I'm going to tell you about it. So as time goes on, I can get your input from it because it's something I've always wanted to do. So I'm writing a new book. This book is, it's not a training book, by the way. Oh, that's different, right? Because all my stuff is mostly training, except for the pilot's diet, which I wrote. But this is built for pilots and the flying public. So what I wanted to do was write a book that, it's called Aviation's Dirty Little Secrets, right? What the public should know about flying is what it is. Because there's a lot of things in airline flying that people have wrong, right? Either they're afraid of it, and they shouldn't be, like passengers, or they're not afraid of something, and maybe it would be a good idea to double check, right? So knowing how the system works, how pilot training happens, and dispelling all these myths about things, like we're constantly in radar contact, where ATC tells us what to do all the time, we have to have perfect vision, we all were in the military, and the Air Force probably, most likely the Air Force, right? We all come out of the Air Force. That's where we got our training, because we fly jets, and that's where they have jets too, right? It's the military. So there are things like that, and just things on the airplane, and just what should be concerning, what's not concerning, how airplanes are certified, what kind of process they go through. So each of these is a chapter in my book that's coming out. It'll be a year before this thing is done. But in that year, it will talk about all those things. It'll talk about how training goes, how frequently it is, what's involved in it. It'll talk about the FAA's input, what check rides are. It'll talk about where pilots come from, how you get selected, what your criteria is, how much it costs. There'll be then a section on air traffic controllers and how they're selected, what the training's like, what they actually do, right? What a typical shift, they do shift work, which is odd, but that's their union had voted for that. So they do 4-day work weeks if you're a radar controller. And so it's kind of odd. They rotate shifts, graveyard, swing, bay. So it's kind of an odd thing. And we talk about, you know, the exhaustion in that job, and fatigue is a better word for it. So anyway, this book is going to sort of set the stage for that. And it's going to describe all these things in aviation, which people have questions about, in an entertaining way, that they're going to give them the answers, right? And then that's the idea of it. So that's going to be coming out here, like I say, in about a year. So I've given myself a year to write it. Like, okay, I don't have anything else to do, right? It's another thing on my plate. But I like the topic. And so I'll be asking our podcast people, our newsletter people, our people in CFI classes for input as the time goes. And that's all I got for you this week. So I'm done. We do have some classes coming out at CFI Bootcamp. They're getting really full. The one I'm teaching in Palo Alto is full. The one I'm teaching in Opa-locka is nearly full. I think there's one seat left in it for the October class. November class is okay still, but getting full. Getting there. You can see the trend of it. So these are all starting to happen. So anyway, if you went in on a class, I would say now's the time, because you got to finish our online course first before you can attend. It's 42 hours long. That's just if you watch the videos. Right. If you don't even pick up a pen, paper, nothing to write any notes or take a, if you don't do the workbook or anything like that. So it's going to take a bit of time, maybe 60, 65 hours. So anyway, best time to get on that is now, and then I'll see you next month. That's it for Flight Training the Way I See It. This has been a production of Flight Training the Way I See It. News, tips, and opinions.